From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Maliha Razazan. Kurds in Iran are estimated to number between 10 to 12 million, comprising 12 to 15% of the total population of Iran. After Persians and Azeris, Kurds are the third largest national groups in Iran. The Kurds in Iran have a long history of a struggle for self-determination that extends decades before the 1979 revolution. In his article in the Middle East Research and Information Project, Sardar Saadi refers to one of the episodes in this struggle when he writes, quote, "In 1946, with the direct help of the Soviet Union, Kurds established their own autonomous republic centered in the city of Mahabad. Although the Kurdish Republic of Mahabad only lasted 11 months, it became a shining example of Kurds successfully ruling themselves and marks the advent of modern nationalism in Kurdistan." Shahram Aghamir spoke with Sardar about the Kurdish struggle for self-determination in Iran. Sardar Saadi is a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of Toronto and host and producer of the Kurdish Edition podcast. Shahram started by asking Sardar about the Kurdish word Rojalat. The Kurds refer to the Kurdish region of Iran as Rojalat instead of Iranian Kurdistan. Rojalat, meaning the place where the sun rises, refers to the eastern portion of Kurdistan, the Kurdish homeland that stretches across four countries of Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria.
One of the main issues that right now many people in Kurdish studies they're dealing with is how to decolonize Kurdish studies. And in Kurdish studies, the terminology that is used to describe the Kurdish people, the Kurdish population widespread in four or five countries of the Middle East, they usually refer to them as in different terms like Iranian Kurdistan, Turkish Kurdistan, or the Kurdish region of Iran, the Kurdish region of Iraq, or northern Iraq, or south or southwestern parts of Turkey, or northwest of Syria. And we see that used by media, by academic scholars who are working in Kurdish studies. And this regards this recent two, three decades, this nomenclature that has come to occupy the terminology of the way that the Kurds describing their own territorial places where they live. So in Rojalat, which is the Iranian part of Kurdistan, western and northwestern parts of Iran, this terminology came to use by the late 1990s, and especially after the expansion of the politics of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, in other parts of Kurdistan. Bakur is the northern part of Kurdistan, which is south and southeast of Turkey. Bashur is northern part of Iraq, which is south part of Kurdistan. And these words also literally mean east, west, south, north. And finally, Rojava, which is the Syrian part of Kurdistan, and it is northern, western parts of that country. And Rojava also means west. So we saw this expansion, especially after the use of new mediums and mass media in Kurdistan, many TVs, especially in the early 2000s. But it was first started by Met TV, this satellite TV that started in 1995 in Europe by the PKK. And in the absence of any medium, there was, like, of course, radios with many parasite waves put by the Iranian regime. But so satellite TV was something very, very new, and people were extremely excited. And the PKK was using this terminology to describe Kurdistan, basically to bring in an anti-colonial discourse into how the Kurds are describing themselves and connect themselves to each other as one entity.
And how widespread is this terminology among the Kurds inside Iran?
As I said, by the late 1990s, but right now everyone is basically using it. And at that time, I remember during the protests in 1999 against the abduction of the PKK's leader Abdullah Öcalan in Tehran, in many cities of Kurdistan and Roshalat. This was one of the slogans that the people were saying, which means north, south, east, one homeland, one struggle. And it was after that that Rosh Halat and other names for other parts of Kurdistan were used based on this PKK-affiliated political perspective. But right now, it is completely widespread, and people refer to different parts of Kurdistan in different countries by this terminology. So I can say that right now, this is part of the everyday language. This has been kind of, quote-unquote, normalized among the Kurds to talk about the different parts of Kurdistan in those terms.
You, as well as other analysts and scholars, identify two distinct projects with respect to the Kurdish question in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. You characterize these two projects as unitary nationalism in the case of the Kurdistan Democratic parties and a radical left paradigm of democratic confederalism in the case of Kurdistan Workers Party, PKK, and I think PYD in Syria. Before we talk about the Kurds in Rojalat, the Kurdish region of Iran, and where they stand vis-a-vis these two discourses, can you briefly explain to us what these two projects stand for?
Right. So when you look at the rise of nationalism and nationalist political movement in Kurdistan, you see this very influential role that traditional groups of people, leaders of people in Kurdistan are involved. So these traditional people could be religious leaders in the case of many sheikhs and sayyids, or in the case of many tribe leaders, so many aghas, the early leaders of this Kurdish nationalist movement. So we have Sheikh Abdullah Gilani in the Shemdina part of Turkey, and also the Margawar Targawar part of Urmia in Iran, in Roshalat, in the western Azerbaijan province, who started basically the first nationalist, Kurdish nationalist movement. And then with the rise of many different groups, many different political movements in Iraq, in Iran, and in Turkey, we see the role that these religious leaders are playing, such as Sheikh Said in Turkey, Sayyid Reza in Turkey, and also in Iraq, Sheikh Mahmoud. And then we have Mullah Mustafa Barzani, that is coming from this tradition, who's a leader of the tribe, his tribe Barzan. And in Iran, we have the first modern nationalist movement that was led by Qazi Muhammad in 1946, that became the Republic of Kurdistan in Mahabad. So these people are coming from this traditional side of the Kurdish society. And then the first Kurdistan Democratic Party was established actually before the Republic of Kurdistan Mahabad, that was led by these traditional leaders of Kurdish society around Mahabad. So many tribe leaders, many aghas, many feudal, and some religious leaders, they were part of them.
They were landlords.
Major landlords, exactly. Mullah Mustafa Barzani was also part of that. He was a general in Mahabad. So the Kurdistan Democratic Party is established with this tradition. But then it was seriously challenged by the rise of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is Jalal Talabani. This group of Jalal Talabani and his comrades, his friends, they started this kind of revolt against Barzani in end of 1960s, early 1970s, and they separated from them. And in Iran, we saw the rise of this leftist Komala party. But then they also became part of this traditional nationalist movement in Kurdistan until the rise of the PKK that was established in 1978 in Turkey. But then the idea was to create an independent socialist Kurdistan coming from a strong leftist history in Turkey, very solid communist background, anti-colonial background, using Fanon, using Mao, and using all the leftist discourses that was there among the Turkish left. And then by the end of 1990s, the PKK became quite widespread all over the Kurdistan. And 2004, 2005, we can probably talk about that in detail later, democratic confederalism, the theory by Öcalan, kind of more leaning toward anarchist ideas of grassroots democracy and gender liberation and preservation of environment, cooperative, communal economy. So this started to become very prominent in Kurdistan, and in Rojava, it also gained a very important place. In Turkey, since 1999, it was its municipal control of the parties that are close to PKK. They controlled all the municipalities, city councils. So they became this alternative political vision where the Kurds can guarantee their rights, can achieve their rights through this more leftist way of seeing what kind of Kurdistan we can create. This was seriously against a vision that the Kurdistan Democratic Parties had for Kurdistan. And we have many different Kurdistan Democratic Parties in all four parts of Kurdistan. And right now, except for some parties, and of course the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, we see this hegemonic power that Barzani and the Kurdistan Democratic Parties has on the nationalist movement in Kurdistan against this the PKK's paradigm of democratic confederalism that also tries to build this entity for Kurdistan, but not in a way that this traditional nationalist political movement is envisioning. This is a difference that we can actually go deeper in. The traditional democratic parties, the way they approach the gender question, the way they approach environment question, the way they approach economy, society, and all of the corruptions that we see in Iraqi Kurdistan, that these parties have become mafia groups that are controlling resources and economy, the state in Iraqi Kurdistan.
It seems to me like one is still a national liberation project that belongs to the anti-colonialist era and liberation movements that are struggling against colonialist rules. It seems like the PKK project is more in line with our current times. In other words, it's not the age of national liberation movements any longer. You're talking about a hegemonic domination of global capital. That seems to be more in tune with the current realities.
Yeah, I agree with that. Many nationalist groups, they would say that in the example of this Trumpist argument for America First, how other big powers like Russia and other countries around the world, like Turkey right now is becoming a sub-imperialist force in the Middle East region, they are emphasizing on their nation, on their national values and national history, and basically fighting against all other minorities, national groups, immigrants, and disregarding any rights, for example, in Turkey for Kurds, or in the UK against the immigrants, or in the United States against the Mexicans, or against people who are coming from Latin America, against Muslims. So we see this nationalist discourse continuing, and many Kurds, they say, well, while the whole world is going in this direction, why should we talk about alternative, beautiful future for our nation, for our region? So there is a big challenge in front of the PKK to convince and to mobilize the Kurdish people to follow this project.
In Nations and Nationalism since 1780, British historian Eric Hobsbawm points out the social engineering which enters into the making of nations. He quotes from a seminal work by Ernest Geller, "Nations as a natural God-given way of classifying men as an inherent political destiny are a myth. Nationalism, which sometimes takes pre-existing cultures and turns them into nations, sometimes invents them and often obliterates pre-existing cultures. That is a reality." And that's the end of the quote. Hobsbawm's basic conclusion is that for the purpose of this analysis, nationalism comes before nations. nations do not make states and nationalism, but the other way around. How useful is this analysis when you look at the formation of the modern state in Iran and the notion of Persian nationalism, as well as the emergence of Kurdish nationalism inside Iran?
I think it is an extremely useful theoretical perspective. It is actually a tool to analyze nationalist movements and the way nation states have been formed throughout the world, but especially in the Middle East. And I'm personally using this very powerful quote that nations do not make states and nationalism, but the other way around. And we see in the example of Turkey that Turkish nationalism created this nation, for example, before coming to Iran, out of the leftovers of Ottoman Empire. And it was meant to dismantle, to clear out, to kill, to massacre, to assimilate any other national subject or people who are unfit for this category of modern Turkish citizen. In Iran, we see the same process with Reza Shah. I think before Reza Shah, we have this constitutional revolution in Iran in 1905 to 1911, started this century of political upheaval that continues until now. In 1925, Reza Khan overthrew the last king of the Khazar dynasty. He was very much assisted by Britain against the rise of the Soviet Union at that time after the October Revolution. So Reza Khan, that became Reza Shah Pahlavi, had these three pillars of building this nation in Iran. And they were personalization of the country, centralization, and westernization.
And the first one was Persianization, right?
It meant basically a campaign of assimilation, a ban on Kurdish language and publication. And there were some other aspects of this westernization, especially Kashfi Hijab.
It was basically unveiling
the national campaign against the traditional clothes. That in Kurdistan, there was actually an uprising by Manar Khalil Gouramari, a religious leader. The main line of his campaign, his uprising, was to protect the traditional clothes for religious leader, for the Kurds, and especially for women. So a lot of this conservative pushbacks against Reza Khan was also mixed with the cultural assimilation campaign that he was pushing. And he was not successful like Turkey, because Iran had a different strategic place in the region, and Reza Khan was basically a puppet in the hands of Britain. And we see that in 1941 that he was basically ousted. So in Iran, it was a different story than Turkey, but the same project of nation building was about this Persian nationalism, this Iranian nationalism, supported by the force of army, going to different regions, different parts of country, trying to bring them together to create this uniform identity, which speaks in Farsi, dresses as this Western code of dress. This centralization that many Kurdish provinces, many Kurds for years were enjoying this relative autonomy in their region with this emirates they have, like some of this power was shared with tribal leaders, with landowners. And of course, it was a very conservative and traditional society, but centralization meant to dismantle everything that pre-existed before the rise of Reza Shah.
What about the emergence of Kurdish nationalism inside Iran?
As I said, Sheikh Abdullah Gilani, we see the rise of this political movement in Kurdistan that has been identified as the first nationalist movement. I think it was end of 19th century, beginning of 20th century. We know that during that time there was a very important war taking place between the Ottoman Empire and Russia that caused the destruction of many parts of Kurdistan and Armenia and northern parts of Iran as well. During that war, we see the rise of this Armenian also identity claims or the territory. And Sheikh Uydullah Gulani wanted to create this independent Kurdistan. Of course, in terms of territory, it was very limited. to his own areas, the border corner of Turkey with Iran and Iraq. So he wanted to create this Kurdish state for the Kurds in that area, and he started this uprising. He was not successful, and we see the rise of nationalism after that. But I want to say that with the invention of nation states in the Middle East, the rise of Kurdish nationalism was actually not so much about inventing the nation state. Many Kurdish nationalists did want to build this independent Kurdistan, but it was more or less against this violent, aggressive nationalist campaigns by central governments in Iran, Iraq, and Turkey.
So it would be fair to say it was a response to emergence or rise of nationalism in Turkey and Iran among the dominant groups.
Kurdish nationalism, by nature, it's some sort of defense, some sort of resistance. Maybe some scholars would disagree with me. It is not as aggressive and as affirmative campaign of nation building as we see in the example of Persian nationalism in Iran and Turkish nationalism in Turkey, but more like a resistance against annihilation, these assimilation campaigns against the Kurds. It has been about preserving Kurdish culture, relative autonomy, Kurdish language, and even Kurdish independence has been some sort of motivation to mobilize the Kurds. But at the end, no political movement in Kurdistan has really followed through this idea of building a nation state for the Kurds. Of course, between 1918 to 1923, that we have the Lausanne Agreement, Kurds were trying to convince the Western powers, the global powers, to give them their own state. Sharif Pasha, we know that during the Sevier Treaty, tried to convince the Western powers to give Kurds an entity, and they agreed. There was like some sort of agreement about giving the Kurds some parts of southwestern Turkey and northern Iraq. But in Iran, there has never been this kind of political movement to build a Kurdish nation state. And we can, of course, talk about some of the examples like the Kurdistan Republic of Mahabad, the uprisings after the Iranian Revolution 1979. And others.
In your article in Merib, you argue that even though an independent homeland may live in the Kurdish collective imaginary, it is autonomy and not independence that has been the dominant demand of the Kurdish movement in all four regions of Kurdistan. You continue by saying that among the Kurds in Iran, even though the demand for Kurdish autonomy persists, but most Kurdish political parties have merged this demand into proposals for a federal system within Iran. What are the characteristics of such a structure, and how does this model compare with the one advocated by Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, in Turkey, or the main Syrian Kurdish organization, the Democratic Union Party, PYD?
We need to look at the different proposals that are on the table by different political parties, Kurdish parties, main ones like the two Kurdistan Democratic Parties and their Komala parties that are following with this model. But some of the main demands are basically, as I said, this relative autonomy for Kurdistan, preserving Kurdish culture, education in mother tongue in Kurdish being part of the official system of education and documentation in Iran, along with other languages spoken in Iran among different national groups. So these are some basic characteristics of this proposal, this federal structure. And of course, it comes with the proposal of democracy for Iran. Without a democratic system, a federal system cannot be, of course. And as you remember, Dr. Qasem Do, beginning of the Kurdish uprising in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution 1979, the main demands were democracy for Iran, autonomy for Kurdistan. But right now, the federal system is not focusing just on Kurdistan, but also on different parts of Iran, giving this multinational, multi cultural, multi-religious nature of the country. What is the difference between this system and what the PKK is proposing is basically that the PKK wants to build up this system, this democratic confederal system, from the bottom and not giving so much power to the central state, not recognizing so much power to the central state and the way representative democracy is working. So as we see in Rojava, this is kind of a similar project that the PKK-affiliated Kurdish parties in Iran, Pejak and Khodar, they are proposing, that the society needs to decide and to go with what kind of political system they want. And this starts from neighborhoods, this starts from all the villages, this starts from the very, very basic cells of this society, and they will propose what they want. So cultural rights, education in mother tongue, and all of those demands that we see in different identity groups in Iran and popular among the other Kurdish opposition groups, kind of similar, but the approach is different. The Kurdish traditional nationalist groups, they do not have this clear proposal for gender liberation, for the relationships between different parts of the society. There's class divisions, the question of religion, and how you're going to deal with this more conservative parts of society that are preventing you from proposing more radical reforms. For example, like in terms of the LGBTQ community, or in terms of different religious practices in a society that we know is, generally speaking, conservative, even though it has changed a lot. So the approach here is very different, and the opposition party's federal model is a kind of proposal to go to the central state, whatever the state is. Let's say in a post-Islamic Republic Iran, you have a state, so this goes to the state, hey, give us this federal system. Of course, there is a struggle behind it, but the way that the PKK is proposing is to build up these communities, these groups, these grassroots organizations, and all the power must be recognized for them. And it is based on this very progressive paradigm of democratic confederalism.
It's basically a model based on direct democracy and sort of a participatory democracy. It's bottom-up instead of top-down. While some of these other models, federalist models, proposed by these other parties, essentially they have their roots in some sort of a liberal democratic discourse.
Yeah, but all of those Kurdish opposition parties, you see Komala, the Communist Party of Iran, led by Mr. Ibrahim Alizadeh, which is the most radical group among the four Komalas who basically separated from the main group. And then we have this social democratic background that Dr. Abdurrahman Qasimlu brought into Kurdistan Democratic Party of Iran, which is right now two groups, and they are also coming from this leftist discourse. But we see that in all of these changes in the region and the social and political transformations that we are seeing, in many of those groups, this leftist politics has remained to discourse, has remained to propaganda, and in many cases we see strong objection against the PKK and democratic confederalism. And in many of the social media accounts of these parties, they are calling out the PKK as this leftist communist group that do not care about the future of Kurdistan, except for the Komala of Mr. Ibrahim Alizadeh, of course. So we see this clash between these two different approaches, this clash between how the future of Kurdistan as part of these countries could be established. But the main point is here that most of these groups, they do not want this different, separate entity, at least for now. But ideologically, the PKK is more in line into a social and political transformation in the whole region. But these groups, Kurdish opposition groups, coming from this unitary nationalism based on Kurdish rights, Kurdish question, except for Komala of Mr. Alizadeh, of course.
That is Sardar Saadi speaking with Shahram Aghamir, about the Kurdish struggle for self-determination in Iran that extends decades before the 1979 revolution. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Comes from a background of being Marxist-Leninist party. You underscore the multi-ethnic and multi-religious fabric of Iran and how such a composition demands a solution that encompasses all identity groups. And you basically suggest that the political strategy of federalism supported by the Kurds and others is mainly a response to this need. What are your thoughts on the other factors that might have played a role convincing many Kurds in Iran to pursue the strategy of federalism? These are pragmatic considerations. To name two of them, the resilience of the state and the central government in Iran that has been withstanding the centrifugal forces and the pressure from below, both under the current regime and the monarchy for nearly a century. Also, the specific demographics of certain areas, such as western part of Azerbaijan, which has a significant Azerbaijani population and non-Kurdish population, not having a monolithic population could complicate the birth of a Kurdish autonomous region in this area.
You know, Iran is one of those countries that has different national groups, and this comes from the history of the Iranian Empire and like continuation of this territorial integrity where different groups, different national groups were kind of mainly encompassed in this nation state after the rise of nation states in the region. So we see this special case. Iran could be compared to many countries, but we know that in Yugoslavia, this multinational country basically dismantled, and we saw this massacres, genocides taking place in the former Yugoslavia, and this separation and invention of different countries. The example of Soviet Union, different countries, different national groups, they had this experience of autonomy for decades. So creation of all of those nation states was not as complicated as in other places. So Iran is one of those countries, maybe one of the last remaining countries where different national groups are living together, are composing this complicated fabric of this country. So why the federal system could be the response that we are looking for is that basically these groups are in different parts of the country, different territorial borders kind of separating different ethnic groups, as you said, different national groups. And by giving a relative autonomy, this provincial autonomy, and recognizing their culture, their language, and envisioning a different Iran, a democratic Iran, with all of them together, is, of course, so many Iranians wish. But politically and in reality on the ground, as you said, there are so many things that could complicate such a project. And as you said, in Western Azerbaijan, for example, the province, we have Kurds and Azeris. And most of the Kurds are Sunni in that province, and most of Azeris are Shia. Despite that, people in cities and villages of Western Azerbaijan, they have so many connections, familial connections, historical connections set together, very deep roots. In my family, we have these familial connections, like getting a bride or giving a bride to Azeri people in the province. And people are kind of more integrated than what we are hearing from this ultra-nationalist rhetoric. And in the example of both the Republic of Kurdistan in Mahabad and the Republic of Azerbaijan in 1946, we saw this collaboration. And like the first Kurdish radio in Iran was established in Tabriz by the Republic of Azerbaijan. So there was this political connection. It was, of course, because of this socialist agenda that the Soviet Union put forward and behind those two republics. But people have very fond memories about those times. We have many Kurdish poems, stories about this relationship with Azerbaijan, with Turks, and we have some of this very amazing Azerbaijani poets, like Ali Rezan Abdel, for example, who has poems supporting the Kurdish struggle for self-determination. But this complication is, of course, could be very fragile when we see how much the Turkish government is trying to kind of initiate this ethnic tension between Azeri Turks and Kurds. In Urmia, for example, and some other cities of northern part of the western Azerbaijan, because southern part, the Mukran part, is mainly Kurdish populated. So the northern part, we see this mix of Kurdish and Turkish cities and even villages. And when it comes to territorial claims, we definitely gonna see some tensions. And a federal system should not be about who controls this village or this farm or this city, but how we are gonna live together without anyone trying to disregard or to eliminate the other one's right to their culture, to their language, to their living conditions, to their social and cultural codes of conduct. I think this is the main point, but I don't want to be naive, and I can totally see that there might be a lot of tensions between different ethnic groups, but the main issue is how the central government, which is controlled by majority Persian Shia population in Iran, is also trying to play with this ethnic cards in different parts. And especially the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic regime, is trying to do that. And before that, Mohammad Reza Shah also tried to do this, to raise this tension, to basically divide and rule. Another thing is that right now, many Kurds, like many of my family members, they live in Tehran. And many Kurds, they live in main cities because of economic reasons. We have a large population of Kurds in Khorasan, in northern Khorasan province. And different cities in Tabriz, which is a central city for Azerbaijan Turks, there are many Kurds. So when it comes to this political system, whatever the future of Iran is like, in some parts it is, of course, about territory, but in most of the cases, it's about what kind of democratic system we can build together. Because with multinational and multi-ethnic, multi-religious character of Iran, we have Baluchi, we have Arabs, we have Turkmen, we have Kurds, we have Azeri, we have Fars, and in Persian, in Fars nation community, we have different groups, like ethnic groups, like Gilak. So how all of that are going to have a peace, a territorial peace, and the future of Iran is very, very complicated.
For the Kurds in Iran, the struggle for self-determination has a long history that predates the 1979 revolution. The Kurds in Iran revived their struggle for self-determination during the Iranian Revolution when they demanded cultural and administrative autonomy for the Kurdish region. What can you tell us about the Kurdish grassroots movements in those early months of the revolution? And how did the new ruling bloc and the central state react to those initiatives?
So it was just very few months. And during this early months of the revolution, there was an absence of nation state. And as soon as there is an absence of nation state rule, the people can organize themselves, set up their councils, their communes, and many grassroots organizations, and especially in urban centers of Kurdistan, and they try to manage their everyday life, also participate in political process of building this new society after the revolution. So we have like a number of women organizations, labor organizations, cultural centers, many publications. They flourished all over many cities of Kurdistan. And this, of course, did not last long. And the newly established Islamic Republic, they attacked Kurdistan right after basically coming back together. And the first campaign was to reoccupy Kurdistan. And through that, all of those organizations, those centers, these groups were dismantled. And in many cases, some of those groups were affiliated with political Kurdish political parties. And the response that they got from the government was a military campaign, as Khomeini said, was going to cleanse Kurdistan.
Exactly. And it was all-out war, including air raids on Kurdish cities, right?
Exactly. And since then, Kurdistan has become very militarized, very securitized. And while there was some level of resistance in the cities, urban warfare between the Kurdish political parties and the Iranian state, but by the end of the day, the Kurdish fighters, Kurdish political parties, all the groups, they were not just Kurdish. Many Iranian groups, especially leftist groups, had come to Kurdistan to find a refuge against the Islamic regime in the center.
And to be fair, they supported the cause. They went to Kurdistan as a matter of solidarity with the Kurdish struggle, because yes, they did recognize the right for self-determination for national groups.
They did, yes. Of course, during that time, the right for self-determination, I think more than that, it was more about how the future of this country is going to shape after the revolution. And the Kurdish demands were mainly around this democracy for Iran and autonomy for Kurdistan. Like having, preserving this autonomous entity that Kurds had built in the aftermath of the revolution.
Essentially a federalist structure, if you like.
The term federalism is quite new,
right? Right.
In Kurdistan, but that time it was more about autonomy, and
right,
autonomy it was coming from this leftist tradition, especially in the Soviet Union, that these different national groups must have their autonomous entities. They need to take care of their own affairs and preserving a language, a culture, etc. They had to leave to the mountains, and many left to Iraqi Kurdistan mountains, to Bashur, some mountains of Rosh Halat, and gradually most of them left the region to Europe, North America, and Australia.
Just to be clear, the demand of the Kurdish political parties and the Kurdish populace in general in that region was not to secede from the entity called Iran. They were asking for autonomy, regional autonomy.
That's true. There was no demand for secession, no demand for separation. Even until now, there's probably one or two marginal groups that they talk about independent Kurdistan. But as I said in the article, independent Kurdistan, of course, it remains in the imaginary of the Kurds as this entity, this country for the Kurds, where they are free, they can have their own national identity. But politically, none of these opposition groups from both sides, the PKK and the traditional nationalist groups or even the leftist groups, none of them propose separation or secession from Iran.
Nevertheless, the power bloc that emerged out of the revolutionary movement, the one who controlled power, decided to quash that movement using violence, essentially. Sardar, in your MERIP article, you write, although the Islamic Republic added Shia Islam to the pre-existing ethno-national features of the Pahlavi state that privileged Persian identity, Kurdish resistance to the newly politicized religious identity was not based on the fact that half of the Kurdish population was Sunni Muslim. Instead of relying on the Shia-Sunni dichotomy for an explanation, you say that the Kurdish movement objection to the Islamist nature of the new regime should be ascribed to a secular religious divide. Can you elaborate?
Sure. So most of the political groups, they kind of agreed on Khomeini's leadership because the goal was clear, to topple the monarchy system of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. But with the rise of this Islamic discourse and just a few weeks after the success of the revolution, Khomeini decided there was this referendum on the constitution or to declare if Islamic Republic is the correct political form for the future of Iran, which was passed apparently by 99%, 98% of the Iranian population. This is a kind of historical fact that is not known, unfortunately. At that time, all the Kurds boycotted this referendum.
There was a boycott, official boycott. That's what the Kurdish parties asked for, and the population more or less followed.
Okay, so the Islamic Republic that came to existence was actually decided by people who are not Kurds, like non-Kurds, like probably some Kurdish people, especially those in southern provinces of Rosh Halat, like in Kermanshah, Ilam, coming from the Shia background, they voted for Islamic Republic, but the politically identified Kurds, politically motivated Kurds, they did not vote, they boycotted this referendum. So we see this rejection, this refusal against the rise of this Islamic regime in Iran. And the fight was, of course, for Kurdish autonomy, of course, for democracy, but also against this Islamization of the political system of Iran, something that the revolution, nobody in the could see that, was abducted by this Rouhaniyat, by this cleric elite of the rising Islamic regime. And it's very interesting that one of the main Kurdish clerics in Mahabad, Sadr Husseini, was actually promoting secular ideas, and he was closer to actually to the leftist party, to Komalab, than even to traditionally nationalist Kurdistan Democratic Party. So the fight was not for this religious identity. The fight was for preserving secular rule in the country.
In addition to the Kurds who boycotted that referendum, so did a lot of other political groups, mainly secular groups, the leftists. They did not find that referendum legitimate. In your piece in Mehrab, you discuss how the post-revolutionary regime in Iran excluded Sunnis in the new constitution and the political structure, and concurrently used religious sectarianism to drive a wedge among Kurds in such a way that most of the Shia Kurds living in Kermanshah and Ilam provinces were less active in the revolt against the Islamic Republic in early stages. Can you explain what these exclusions entail for Sunnis in general and Sunni Kurds in particular in terms of their rights as Iranian citizens? Tell us how the regime used this Sunni-Shia binary that is so popular these days among some analysts in its campaign to quash unrest in the Kurdish region.
Historically speaking, the Kurdish nationalist movement kind of territorially belonged to the northern parts of Rosh Halat, to the southern parts of the western Azerbaijan province, areas close to Mahabad, and later to Kurdistan province, Sanandaj, Merivan, Panas, Akkuz, and not so popular in the southern parts of Rosh Halat, where the majority Kurds are Shia. And we also have Ahle Haqqiya Isan, considerable percentage of the people, the Kurdish population in the Kermanshah province, they're Ahle Haqqiya Isan. So in those areas, we can't see this Kurdish nationalist sentiments being built up before the revolution. And this binary that you mentioned, the Sunni-Shia, kind of exists between southern parts of Rosh Halat and northern parts, where the northern parts is mainly Sunni Shafi'i. But we also have Shia Kurds in the Kurdistan province, like in Bijar, Gurba cities, in western Azerbaijan, maybe in Tikab and Sayyid-Kala cities, we have Shia Kurds. But the main divide was between the two provinces of Kermanshah and Ilam, with the Kurds in the provinces of Kurdistan and western Azerbaijan. But just note that in Kermanshah, we have Sunni Kurds in Hewraman, in Pave and Juanro. So the Kurdish uprising in the aftermath of the revolution took place mainly in those Sunni populated Kurdish cities, like in Sanandaj, Merivan, Mahabad, and other cities that I mentioned. And Shia Kurds, they did not participate in this uprising, as you said. And the very nature of the raising religious regime was kind of welcoming this Shia identity of the Kurds in those parts. And because at that time, like during the early years of the revolution, the emphasis was mainly on the Shia identity, and we see the coming back of the Persian identity much later in the Islamic Republic of Iran, this Shia identity was kind of more powerful than the Kurdish identity for most of the Kurds in those parts. And the very issue that, as you mentioned, that in the newly approved constitution of the Islamic regime, Sunnis were basically deprived from many rights, from being elected, from being represented. In many parts of the newly established institutions of the state, they did not get any positions. So Shia Kurds, they basically became more powerful in the regime and the regimes and institutions in different parts of Kurdistan, especially in Sanandaj, Kamyaran, and other parts. And they, the Shia Kurds, became the face of the regime in those parts, less in the northern parts, in Mahabad, Sakkas, Urmia, and other parts. So we see this regime's attempt to, as you said, to basically use the Sunni-Shia binary to divide the Kurdish population.
Let's turn to the economy of the Kurdish region. I think this is a pivotal issue. The region's economy was traditionally based on agriculture and animal husbandry in rural areas and commerce in the urban centers, as you point out. In your articles, you cite the limited number of industrial sites and their locations along the outer edge of Kurdish provinces as evidence for long-term policies of de-development in Rojalat by the central state and an economy based on Iran's security and military. Can you talk about those policies and their impact on the population and the labor force in Kurdistan?
Well, in my university years in Iran, I did my first research about the balance of industrial development in Kurdistan, especially in the Kurdistan province, and how the government's, central government's investment in Kurdistan is taking place. And at that time, I found out, by looking at different factors, different parameters, that most of the industrial sites are actually located quite close to the border cities, the border areas of the Kurdistan province, where actually Shia Kurds are living. And the population is mainly Kurdish Shia. So in the cities of Khorva and Bijar mainly. And from that time, it was a very important question for me to see how the economy of Kurdistan is taking shape by the ways in which the state invests or proposes development projects in the region. And in many parts of Kurdistan, we see this tremendous number of unemployed young people who have to leave their cities, their villages, to go to different parts of Iran, to the southern parts, to in oil fields, to many brick factories called Kurakhana, brutal places of exploitation of people's labor. In many parts of Iran, central parts of Iran, especially in bazaars, markets for fruits, we can see, like I personally, during the time that I was living in Iran, most of those places where they were selling tarabar, like fruits and vegetables, we know all of those who were working there because they were Kurdish from different cities of Kurdistan. And many construction sites, Kurdish youth were working in different parts of Iran. So we see this de-development policies of the regime in the way that it drives the Kurdish youth to find their sources of livelihood in other parts of Iran. So in Iran, in general, we cannot talk about this advanced level of industrialization, and except for the oil industry, in other areas, these industries are kind of very much located in the central provinces. But in Kurdistan, especially with the securitization and militarization of the region, It was basically, I think, even speaking in economic terms, in business terms, it was a risk for any sort of investment in that region while a political unrest was taking place, was ongoing. The development had some reasons behind it, as I said, this political situation of Kurdistan, but also some very intentional politics of the regime by driving out the Kurdish youth from that region and taking them to other parts of Iran, and not giving the Kurds these sources of livelihood in their own places of living, their own villages, their own cities. By mid-2000s, we see that a new economy, which is a border market, rising in Kurdistan, that of course we can talk about that, and how this is kind of taking a toll on the Kurdish youth, that they're basically trying to survive.
Sardar Saadi is a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of Toronto and host and producer of the Kurdish Edition podcast. He spoke with Shahram Aghamir. You can read his article titled The New Wave of Politics in the Struggle for Self-Determination in Rojalat online at merib.org. Please join us next week to hear the second part of this interview. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
You can find us on Twitter at @Vomina_radio or listen to our past shows on iTunes or SoundCloud at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can also reach us by email at vominaradio@gmail.com. Please join us next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and thank you for listening.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Dreams called on. back to the fire and eyes to the sea. I sit at home with my hand on the cradle, rocking the love he has given to me. Long are the hours and long is...
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the Way Live Radio, CKUT, 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Big shout out to CKUT. I was inspired from last week's show doing a kind of collage, audio collage for MF Doom. And this week is going to be an audio collage of Old Dirty Bastard. So I put together some of my favorite clips on YouTube, some great interviews. Yeah, just put that together with some tracks, going back and forth between the two. Hope you enjoy it. So for all the Old Dirty Bastard fans out there, you're going to recognize a lot of things, and it may give you that itch to go and watch some of those amazing videos. And obviously, I couldn't put as much as I wanted to in the show. So many great clips, and not everything can be played in the middle of the day on the radio, but